Welcome to the Essential Church Podcast. Our goal is to strengthen and equip church and ministry leaders just like you through practical and theological discussions about some of the most pressing and important issues facing the local church today. We feature conversations with members of our team here at New Life Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado, as well as interviews with authors and thinkers from around the world. You can follow the essential.church on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Watch episodes on our YouTube channel and also subscribe to our podcast via iTunes and Spotify, where you'll find a full archive of previous conversations. And now, here is this week's episode of the Essential Church Podcast.
Welcome to this episode of the Essential Church Podcast, an ongoing conversation about some of the most important issues facing the local church today. I'm your host, Andrew Arndt. And today I want to take you to a conversation that Daniel Grothy and I had recently with Sharon and Ike Miller. They are the pastors of Bright City Church out in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. Beautiful young congregation that they planted and are pastoring together. We have a nice conversation with them about what it's like to pastor a church together, some of the challenges that they're seeing to discipleship in the American church today, as well as some advice that they find themselves giving to people on the regular these days. It's a great conversation. These guys are some of the most thoughtful, fresh, insightful leaders that we have in the local church. We think you're going to enjoy the conversation. And so without further ado from me, here's to the interview. We're really happy to have on the podcast today Sharon and Ike Miller. They are the co-pastors of Bright City Church in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, which exists to help restore people to relationship with God, one another, and themselves. Both Ike and Sharon earned their MDivs from Duke Divinity School, and they got their PhDs together at the same time at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, which, little autobiography, that's also my alma mater. But we love Ike and Sharon. We love them for how fresh and thoughtful they are. I think that they're much-needed voices in the church today. So Ike and Sharon, we're glad to have you guys.
So good to be on here, and thank you guys for having us. You know, until you read all of that, I didn't realize, man, it may seem like we just do everything together. Like, we can't do things separately.
We do our MDiv together, our PhDs together, plant churches together.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good place to start. I would actually, when I read y'all's bio, I was like, okay, I got to know more about these people. So here they are getting their MDivs from Duke and then PhDs from Trinity. And can you tell us in a couple minutes, like, give us the little snapshot, the story of your relationships? We got some context for you guys.
We met in a date auction. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, that will, like, take away all the prestige. Like, how we met is...
You did really actually meet in a date auction? I don't even know what a date auction is.
Well, Ike likes to emphasize that it was a charity event.
It was. It was a fundraiser, you know.
And he was being auctioned off. I was done with seminary. You were a first year at Duke. Mm-hmm. And the Duke University Graduate School was doing this charity date auction. And so people were auctioned off, and the money was all going towards a local charity. And so Ike was being auctioned off with, like, a date.
This is great. Wow. Can't make this stuff up.
No.
Well, I will tell you, though, it doesn't end, like, the way you think it is.
No. Nope.
So I was there because I had a friend who was being auctioned off, and so I was there to support them.
She was his security blanket.
I was there, like, if he didn't get auctioned off, like, I was there as, like, the backup. So I met Ike there, but I did not bid on him.
Yeah. On the other hand, I'm up there thinking, like, Sharon is definitely bidding on me right now, like, 100%, to the point where I went off the stage, went straight to Sharon to say thank you for bidding on me. And not only bidding on me, but paying whatever it was going to take to get a date with me. And she's like, I did not bid on you.
Yeah.
And crushed my spirits a little bit.
But and that was like, that was actually like
almost exactly 15 years ago.
It was like the week before Valentine's Day.
Yep.
So that's how we met. And then you asked me out. Like, the next week.
I did.
So, yeah.
There's a better than good chance that you're the only pastors in the history of the church that have had your relationship begin in that way. That was a novelty in the history of the universe. I hope that you're patting yourselves on the back for that.
It's not how I expected to meet my husband.
You just need to start leading with that.
Okay, so I got to ask then, did both of you, like, at about the time that you get together and your relationship is happening, are both of you carrying separate dreams for pastoring a church one day, and then those kind of come together? Or did you discover that between the two of you? Tell us about how the dream for Bright City Church came about.
Sharon has actively resisted doing ministry with me. it took me saying, God has called us to do this, for her to say, okay, fine. No, I think, so when we finished seminary, I was still figuring out, did I want to go into academia? Did I want to do pastoral ministry? Figuring that out. I don't think Sharon ever had the intention of doing pastoral ministry.
Well, at the time, so when we got married, our first year of marriage, we were at a Southern Baptist church. So we were at the Summit Church here, which is J.D. Greer's church, if you're familiar with him. Mm-hmm. And so, great church. Wonderful church. We love it. But Southern Baptist. And so I did not think being a pastor, mm-hmm. that was not on my radar at all. And then you were sort of thinking, you were applying for PhD programs, and so you were kind of thinking academia. Mm-hmm. You were sort of, it was like a toss-up. And so when we moved away from here, that was kind of our natural break with the SBC. Like, I don't think we would have, we loved Summit. We were not upset with Summit or anything like that. And so that was just kind of a natural end of that chapter. And then during our doctoral work is when you decided you actually wanted to be in the local church. I still was not thinking I was going to be a pastor. There just was no, I was just writing and speaking, sort of, you know, supporting the local church, but not pastoring. And so it wasn't until we discerned the call to plant that Ike was the one really advocating for me to take on that role. But he was joking, but it was true. Before that, he was serving as a young adults pastor, and he said, I keep feeling like God wants us to do something together. And I couldn't imagine what that would be. Huh. And so I was like, I don't think so.
Uh-huh. Shoot me down. I don't know. Shoot me down.
So what's it like to lead a church together? You've got kids, what, 10, 7, 5, uh-huh. right? Three little kids. The church is 4 years old, years old.
Yep.
You just signed your first lease on your first office space. So mm-hmm. you've been kind of following the pillar of cloud and, you know, like wandering through the... So like, what is it like to lead a church, young, fresh married couple with young mm-hmm. family? Tell us about mm-hmm. that.
It's a constant learning process.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, you know, when we started the launch of the church, all of that, I think we both were just so driven by adrenaline and this is mm-hmm. what's got to be done. But we're really running at a pace that wasn't ultimately sustainable. And so I think a part of our process has been learning what is our pace, what is a manageable pace, how do we balance, you know, leading this church, but not in a way that is at the cost of our children or a cost to our children. And so we're just constantly learning, you know, how to navigate as we go into different seasons as a church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're learning a lot by making mistakes because we don't know many couples who are doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
We planted with ARC, if mm-hmm. y'all are familiar. Yep. I think you are.
Yep. Yeah.
And they have a lot of the couples that plant with ARC, the wife has a pastor title, but is not actually necessarily like on staff leading,
right.
you know, in the capacity where we are co-leading our church together. And so we've struggled to find, we have reached out to a few couples that are doing what we're doing, but because there aren't any roadmaps, we're sort of
right.
drawing our own map. And mm-hmm. and even when you reach out to other couples, a lot of them have done what works for them and yep. their marriage
right.
and their personalities. But if our personalities and our gifts are different,
yeah.
then it shakes out differently for yeah. us. And so that has been hard. We've just been figuring it out as mm-hmm. we go.
Yep.
We've had to really, every time we've laid down boundaries, we've realized we've needed to tighten them even yeah. more because church planting is really all encompassing. Mm-hmm. And so it just is constantly trying to bleed into. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I think in the last year, we reached a point where we realized, okay, we are co-pastors and co-parents. But where is the romance?
You know, right, right, right.
And so yeah. we've really had to, in the last year, super duper prioritize that. Mm-hmm. So it's not, we have not done it perfectly at all.
If I understand right, Sharon, I think you're the teaching pastor for Bright City, and then Ike, your designation is like lead pastor, or how are you guys, well, how are you guys splitting that up?
Several iterations
okay.
of things.
Okay.
Yeah, we changed my title at one point just to limit the scope. When we launched the church, we had just had our third child. I was finishing my second book. It was just chaotic. And I didn't think I had the bandwidth for that co-lead pastor title. And so we limited just to teaching pastor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but even before that, you know, we launched as just lead pastors. Mm-hmm. And I think within the first year or so, we realized that was really confusing for our staff.
To have two lead pastors. Like,
do I have one boss? Do I have two bosses? Sure. If you guys disagree on something, who do we go with? You know, all of that kind of stuff. And so that was when we made the decision to designate my title as lead pastor, her as teaching pastor. And that way we could create some division of labor. Here's our org chart, all of that kind of stuff. But we quickly realized that didn't work super well because that meant I was now Sharon's boss in a weird kind of way. So we've moved back to, you know, co-lead pastor and we could go into that whole story, but it's been through several iterations.
But we've clarified, this wouldn't be on a website or anything, but we've clarified for our purposes and for our staff kind of what our lanes are.
That's good. Yeah, for
as
sure.
co-lead pastors. And then we really try to own.
Stick
and
to it.
We've also decided that we want to be in as few meetings together as possible.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, because even just, you know, any friction that we have in meetings, it's hard to just leave it at the door. Yeah. And so we're trying to kind of weed out the work piece as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So we're still very much learning.
Well, I think it's a question for any, because there are so many churches across the country that are moving towards more flat leadership models, you know, where you have like multiple lead pastors maybe. So this is a question that would apply to any of them, but how do you guys handle tiebreakers between you? So if you can't come to a consensus or agreement on an issue, how does that work for you so that the church doesn't get stuck?
Yeah, so that was a part of us determining kind of what our lanes are was really based on gifting and passions. So what is Sharon gifted in and passionate about? What am I gifted in and passionate about? And taking that to determine some of our lanes and where we're in leadership, where we make the final decision. And so we kind of broke that down. And so I have certain things that I make the final call on, certain things Sharon makes the final call on. But then within that, you know, if there's something that both of us feel like we have a lot of stake in that's really important, that's where we don't have an elder board established yet. That's in the kind of the next year or two that we're moving in that direction. But we have an advisory board. And so they kind of make the final vote that.
Got it. Okay. Well, as you guys, so your church is 4 years old, you said? Yep. Is that right? When did you all launch?
September of 2018.
Oh, okay. So you had about a year and a half under your belt, and then the world came to an end. We went through an apocalypse, and now we're out on the other side. But tell us what you guys are seeing. You know, you're looking at your congregation and assessing some of the gaps in discipleship, things that have you concerned. What are some of those things that have you concerned as far as discipleship, as you see it in your church? And I think probably those things are shared by a lot of churches across the country. So what are you seeing?
So we are in, even though we're in the Bible Belt, we are in a very progressive area.
Yeah.
We're in this extremely progressive enclave. And so that's a very weird demographic where everyone here has probably spent some amount of time in a Southern Baptist church. But also a lot of people have church baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a lot of people who come to our church who are cynical about church, who are coming with pain from other churches, just a spectrum of that. And so we have realized a big part of our call, and I think this is a broader conversation about how to do this well, because if you get on social media, it's just a dumpster fire. You know, it's very much venting about the church without any constructive way forward. And so one of the things that we feel really called to as a church is, on the one hand, to receive people with compassion, to be a really safe and healing place for people coming to our church, to make sure we are sensitive to aspects of evangelical subculture that could feel disingenuous to people, you know, that sort of a thing. But at the same time, helping restore people to the church with a capital C, not necessarily Bright City Church, because people are coming very often saying, you know, we feel really safe at your church, you know, unlike these other churches, and we're so glad we found Bright City, and we're kind of like, great, I'm so glad you're here. I hope that this is a place where you can heal. I hope that this is a safe place for you, but also, just going to go ahead and tell you, we are going to disappoint you. We are going to screw up. You know, you're going to probably experience some sort of hurt here just because that's what happens in human relationships. And so our, you know, you mentioned the mission statement of restoring people to God, others, and self. But our kind of tagline is helping people take their next step towards Christ so that they can experience restoration to God, others, and self. But that helping people take their next step towards Christ is really important for us to, every Sunday we say, wherever you're coming from, whatever you're bringing into the door, whatever your doubts or cynicism, our question for you is, what is your next step towards Christ? And how can we partner with you in that? And so I think that is a really important conversation. And honestly, one person who's doing a great job of that is Natalie Runyon. I think she's really threading that needle that we need to simultaneously be able to say, yes, this happened to you. This was bad. This was wrong. This grieves God's heart. Also, the church is God's plan A for discipleship. And so that's something that we have really worked hard to also thread that needle. And then the other thing that I just think about all day long, and this is like my big, I think this is a huge issue in discipleship, is consumerism and the ways that it's shaping how churches do evangelism, how churches are attracting people, but also every week people are coming to church and they're saying, this is my list of what I want in a church. And I've, you know, I've gone to this church over here, which I think that's a great church. That's a great church. But here's my issue with it. And they'll say, and I visited this other church. I'm thinking, that's a great church.
If you can't be happy there, you can't be anywhere.
And I think it is bad for discipleship because it means as soon as a church doesn't suit you, you just move to another church, which is not how we form, you know, how we are formed. But I think it is chewing up and spitting out pastors because it's dehumanizing. It's like commodifying the pastorate. And so that's something else that I am deeply concerned about. And I feel like I'm screaming into the void a little bit on social media because I think it's a major, major issue. And I'm not sure. I think it's much more of a, you know, this is a problem. I think it's a big problem. So that's something that really concerns me.
Hey guys, Andrew here, cutting in real quick just to remind you of our upcoming Essential Church Learning Community here in Colorado Springs, February 21st and 22nd. It's a couple days of conversation around the theme of healthy church. What does it mean to be a healthy church? We talk about some of the key indicators of healthy church. We're going to talk about developing a healthy staff and leadership culture. We're going to talk about some of the principles of self-leadership, self-management. And then we're also very pleased to welcome special guest Caitlin Beatty, author of Celebrities for Jesus, to talk about the problem of celebrity in the contemporary church and what we can do about it. It's going to be a great couple days together. Spots are limited, so head to our website and register today.
Ike, can I ask you a question? She mentioned you want to be a safe place for people to bring their pain, but also to restore them to the Big C Church. Can I ask you some formative practices that you have found to reintroduce people to the story that tenderizes, that softens? Is it the, is it knowing the creed? Is it the sacraments? Like, what have you discovered is a great way to bring a healing practice back to people who have been hurt by the church?
Honestly, I think, and this isn't necessarily practices, but I think in terms of moving the church in that direction, a huge thing has just been us as leaders being vulnerable about our struggles and areas that we are growing in, pain that we've experienced, our own stories, our own childhood experiences. I think that just communicates such a sense that, hey, this isn't a place for you to come in and have it all together. This is a place for broken people, for people with pain. And, you know, so I think that that's been huge. I think the other thing that we've done that's been huge is, and this is maybe feels far afield of what you're asking, but we have really put an emphasis on how do we as leaders listen well to our people? How do we create structures in our church for us to listen to our people? Because so much of the hurt that people are coming in with is a sense of, I wasn't heard. There was no space for me to communicate. It wasn't taken seriously. And so really those have been some of our rhythms, or how do we have rhythms of listening, not just talking, but listening, vulnerability. But then I think in terms of practices, taking some of those ancient practices and bringing them into conversation with things like trauma-informed counseling. So taking something like Lectio Divina, which is a huge, a crucial practice in terms of not just reading and understanding Scripture, but communing with God's Spirit through the text. And bringing into that, okay, you know, as I step into this, what's the pain I'm feeling today?
Right.
What's the emotion I'm dealing with? What's the anger that I'm feeling today? And allowing God's Word and God's Spirit to meet you in the midst of whatever it is that's going deep inside your heart right now.
So good. I want to ask you, Sharon, you wrote a book recently called The Cost of Control. And, you know, it's about, which is all about sort of our addiction to control and how that is detrimental to our relationships, our spirituality, our mental health. How much do you think that some of our penchant for control is also playing into the consumerism? And so I'm thinking about the loose affiliation that people have with churches. Some of that is because we've been hurt before, as you pointed out earlier. So I wonder if you could just speak to that a little bit. Do you think some of this, you know, desire to like hold church at arm's length is actually us just trying to manage our experience and make sure that we're not we're not hurt, we're not surrendering ourselves?
Right. Yeah. So I have a section of the book where I look at different ways that we try to exert control over our lives. And one of the chapters is on autonomy as a form of control and how we don't want anyone telling us what to do. And I acknowledge there's a reason for that. There's a good reason for that, that we, there's so many stories of church abuse, institutional abuse. You know, you think of like USA Gymnastics. And in a lot of those situations, especially in religious contexts, what happens is the victims are taught not to trust their own intuition, essentially. And so it's totally understandable why, with all these stories coming out, there would be this strong push. And then on top of that, we are just in a highly individualistic culture that really emphasizes personal rights as sort of, you know, the peak American value. And so I get all that. I think it's important to affirm some personal autonomy, but to also acknowledge that absolute autonomy undermines the fundamental design of the church. I have this one line where I say, you can be in control or you can be in community, but you can't be both. And I, 1 Corinthians 12 is really huge for us as a church, like our understanding of what it means to be the body of Christ. It's an interdependent body of many parts. And I think when absolute autonomy, when that, that control is leading the way, it's basically everyone wants to be the head. And the head is Christ. The head is Christ. But we don't want to be accountable to one another. We don't want to be interdependent with one another. And so that's a huge issue. It's a huge problem. And I think it plays out in a lot of different ways. That's just one.
Can I ask you about one particular vocational difficulty for us. We all have these situations in our own work. I think for pastors, friendship in the church can be difficult at times. And I've heard you two talk about the difficulty of when you planted a church, you assumed that all of your friendships would just stay exactly the way they were and that people would travel with you, not necessarily come to the church with you, though that's always great, but just like be able to keep up with your story in the same way, but your story dramatically changed. And I think pastors live in a bunch of asymmetrical relationships with people that we're serving, which heightens the need for our own kind of solid friendships. Mm-hmm. So can you talk to us about what you've learned through pastoral ministry about maintaining healthy friendships?
Gosh, I think you're talking to the wrong people.
In the spirit of vulnerability, the way you lead your church, what are you learning? What are you aching for? What are you hoping for?
I think what I'm learning is how to navigate heartache, honestly. I think that just as there's the desire to control their experience as a attender of the church, I think there's a desire to control my experience as a pastor of the church.
Yes.
And so what that means is creating distance between me and people, especially if I've been recently wounded by a relationship. And so how do I have the process in place by which I grieve heartache, but don't become hardened by that in a way that I can't enter into those friendships again, and not find myself in a place where I can't be friends with people in my church. You know, there's all kinds of perspectives on that, very strong feelings, but I love the people in our church. I love hanging out with the people in our church. Right. I love spending time with the people in our church. I don't want, insofar as it's possible, for there to be this like asymmetrical, tiered kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. And so how do I have processes in place so that when there is heartache and pain, I find a way to get back to a tenderness towards our people?
That's so good.
For me, this has been like a major, major wound for me for like the last 5 years. And I'm still not on the other side of it, but we are finishing up a series called Heartaches. And I was assigned to preach on friendship, which
know how this goes.
You
proposed the topic. Right.
I was like, somebody needs to teach on friendship for me. So, but one thing that I actually learned when I was researching that has been really helpful for me is I had this narrative in my head that basically I don't have any friends. Like my one friend is Molly. Like Daniel, I know you know Molly.
Molly Stillman.
Yeah, Molly's the best. She's the best. And so I would always say, like, I have one friend and it's Molly. Like, close friend. Mm-hmm. But when I was researching on friendship, I learned about this concept. It's called Dunbar's number. And Dunbar's number is 150. That's the kind of max number of people that you can actively maintain some sort of relationship with. But that number 150 is on a spectrum. And if you move further to the right on the spectrum to bigger and bigger numbers, you're getting into like, oh, this is the max number of acquaintances. This is the max number of names that you can remember. This is the max number of faces that you can recognize. Mm-hmm. But then if you move further to the left and get smaller and smaller, you're getting into these closer knit groups of friends. But then the smallest number is 5. And that is like your most intimate. And some of this just has to do with sheer number of hours that you spend with them each week or month. Right. And so there's a max of 5. You can't fit more than 5 in this intimate circle. And that would include like your spouse. That might include your kids. Mm-hmm. And so that ticks off that number 5 right away. For me, 2 of those spots are filled by my parents. And so when I saw that number, I thought, well, actually, I have about 4 to 5 of those really, really close people.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of them is a friend outside of my family, but there's nothing wrong with that circle being occupied by your family.
Yep. Right.
And I think for pastors, that probably is going to be the case. I think you do need to have people outside your family as well who know what's going on inside of your marriage. But that kind of changed the story for me that I think who were in my tighter circle that moved further to the right when I planted.
Yeah.
And that process was painful, but it didn't mean the friendship ended. It just meant they it weren't shifted. In that tight, tight circle yeah. anymore. So that was so helpful for me.
It's good wisdom. Very. It's like recognize who's already there in some yeah. ways, you know? Like, yeah. I think that some of us are more friendship rich and relationship rich than we realize. Okay, mm-hmm. we need to wrap up in just a second here, but last question, and I want each of you to answer this. What's one piece of advice or wisdom that you find yourself giving over and over and over again? Like a theme that you find yourself speaking to when you're talking to pastors, leaders, congregants, whoever, what's something you find yourself saying often?
I'll go first. I have constantly been beating the drum of understanding how your emotional world is driving your actions and decisions, and not just surface level, like I'm angry and therefore I'm acting this way, but why are you angry? And right. why did what you're angry about make you angry? And going all the way down and kind of helping people understand, like, there's some things that you believe about yourself or that you think will make you true to the identity you want to have that are driving your decisions. And until you know what that is, you're never going to fix that thing that you want to fix. And so that's what I've been having a lot of conversations about constantly.
So good. I think. Mm.
For me, I'm going to share something that I've just been sharing with other people about us that I think is a helpful metaphor as we're coming out of the last 3 years, especially for other leaders.
Did we talk about this first? Are you telling stories?
So coming into the pandemic, I feel like the bank accounts for our marriage, our emotional health, our spiritual health, we're like at real high. Like our marriage was really strong. We had lots of energy, lots of enthusiasm, lots of vision, you know, all of that. I feel like we spent down all those accounts in the last 3 years. We spent them all down just getting our church plant through the pandemic. Some are emptier than others. And that was helpful for me to realize part of my work right now is reinvesting back into the accounts. I've already talked about our marriage, realizing we kind of spent down a lot. Mm-hmm. And so we need to take a beat and we really need to just put back in. And I think we're in a season where the way people talk a lot about boundaries is very much like, I'm tired. I just need to have a boundary. And what they really mean is, like, they just don't want to do that thing. And I want to be really clear, that's not what I'm talking about. Intentionally resting, intentionally investing yourself so that you can, you know, get back into the race. So I'm, like, mixing metaphors now. But for me, that's been something to really acknowledge, that we need to be intentionally investing back into our spiritual lives and our emotional health and our marriage so that we can do this for the long run.
Yeah.
So good. Ike and Sharon Miller, we're so grateful for you guys. Thanks for your good leadership of your church and your witness in the church at large. You can grab Sharon's book, Cost of Control, wherever fine books are sold, anywhere actually. And but we're grateful that you guys joined us today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.